Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
The health of the former US President Joe Biden has been in the headlines recently, not just in relation to his cancer diagnosis, but also centering on revelations in a book by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson called Original Sin, which focuses on the White House's efforts to hide his deteriorating health during his last year of the presidency. Now, the health of the person in one of the most powerful jobs in the world has always been a source of huge interest to the public, and some may say rightly so, because with that job comes huge responsibility. Well, to take us through how ill health affected some US presidents, I'm joined by Graham Finley from the UCD School of International Relations. Hello, Graham.
Oh, yeah.
Good to have you with us. Now, it's probably no surprise that that job can take its toll on an individual's health, right?
Yeah, I went through the health of all the presidents just out of sheer curiosity. And they've always had physicians, but it only becomes an official role. It's so important it is to the state that it's only become an official role around 1901 as a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And then in 1928, they pass legislation giving an official White House doctor.
Right, it's not so totally, it has to happen.
It's not mm-hmm. totally clear from the legislation exactly which position, because there are ostensibly separate positions of heading the White House medical unit and being the physician to the president. In practice, it's the same person. And there's quite a substantial White House medical unit in place with multiple nurses and doctors and on Air Force One, for example, and various emergency supplies. But on Air Force One, there's an operating theater or an operating table, operating theater lights and all the equipment needed to operate on the president.
Right. And the Qataris are building that right now for Donald Trump.
that's one of the modifications they're going to have to make with the new plane.
And listen, who appoints that doctor then? Is that the administration in place at that moment who makes the appointment?
They do. And some of the former White House physicians have become politicians in their own right, like the very colorful Ronnie Jackson, who was, as usual, appointed from the military. Many of them recently have come from the Navy at the rank of captain. Mm-hmm. He was promoted to admiral under Donald Trump and then demoted back to captain after a series of investigations into allegations of overprescribing and bad behavior on
right.
his part.
Now, Joe Biden, who we mentioned at the beginning, he's not the only U.S. president to navigate illness while in office, is he?
In fact, quite a few of them did. And in the early days, not surprisingly, the medical care which was available was pretty bleak. George Washington had the first operation as president to remove a malignancy, which may have been a bacterial abscess, from his leg, which saved his life. This was in New York. And he later died, after he'd been president, from bloodletting, which may have also claimed the life of William Henry Harrison. So very often, the actual cures which were brought to bear on the president ended up killing them. Another example of that, and this was something I was sort of delighted, but obviously is horrible, is James A. Garfield was shot by a Republican office seeker. He probably died because his physician, Dr. Bliss, was looking for the bullet to get it out
yeah.
and stuck his sort of dirty fingers, given the time, into the wound, and then failed to listen to Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. Who was brought there. It's the president. You need to bring these things to bear, bringing a very early metal detector to try and look for the bullet. But Bliss insisted it was in a certain place, whereas Alexander Graham Bell was right that it was somewhere else, and the bullet stayed in Garfield, and then he succumbed to his wounds eventually.
And the infection may have been caused not by the bullet but by the dirty hand.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to the demands of the job, how demanding is it?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think any of us can really imagine. I've thought this a lot when talking about presidents, just what it would be like to have to make all these decisions. And you see the toll taken even on someone as fit as Barack Obama, who famously went gray in the job. Now, whether he sort of let himself go gray to seem more statesmanlike is a debated question. But, you know, there are presidents like Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama who seem to have been kind of on all the time, or Bill Clinton. And although I'm not making a party political point, presidents like George W. Bush and Donald Trump, at least allegedly, who treat it a little more like a 9-to-5 job, or a job which can be done in a certain set of hours and reserve a certain amount of personal time for mm-hmm. themselves. But I don't think it's not a job which one person can do. And I think in the recent debates about Joe Biden, you have to ask yourself, Do you want one human being absolutely deciding every single aspect of political life and of the running of a government as big as that of the United States? Jimmy Carter famously tried to micromanage it, and it didn't work very well, right? You need to have a really good team around you who can advise you, who can, you know, read the documents and present them to you in a palatable and understandable fashion.
But even with that, it's ultimately you who are making those decisions. And does it even make a difference if you carve out your personal time? If you go to Mar-a-Lago at the weekend and play golf, you're still having to grapple with what to do next.
You are. I mean, it probably comes down to your personality. I think different presidents respond differently to the demands of the job. Some really become concerned with everything. Maybe they think that everything's going to look badly on them. Some are confident in their judgment, right? And assume that whatever decision they make is the right one. And I think when you come to politicians, especially ones who become president, they all believe that they're the best person for the job. They're the only person who can make these decisions. You don't see a lot of crises of confidence in the Oval Office. And so they tend, even if they're just going with their gut, even if they don't know what they're doing, frankly, they're confident that they're the person to make that decision.
Right. Okay. Now, let's go back to some of the earlier U.S. presidents and some of the examples that you've managed to find for us. William Henry Harrison. Tell us about him.
Yeah. I mean, again, in a time of poor medical care, he took a lot of risks. He gave the longest inaugural address in history, which was almost 2 hours long. Rode around Washington all day without a coat or a hat. And it was apparently very chilly because inaugurations were still in March at that time. He then went out in a rainstorm, or was caught in a rainstorm, on March 24th, so 20 days later, and eventually succumbed to pneumonia. Again, possibly because of the bloodletting, which was involved, and all the other sort of cures, which none of which we would practice now, were involved in, but possibly because of the poor sanitation of Washington itself. It's famously built on a swamp, and the White House is downstream, basically, from like open sewers. And so a number of presidents may have died of typhus or some other disease caught from just dirty water.
Right, but he just refused to put his coat on as well, which could have been a factor.
Yeah, a lot of these guys were former generals, and so there was a sort of machismo in play.
John Tyler then was his successor, wasn't he? He came after William Harrison.
Yeah, he also suffered from ill health, but it didn't keep him from, this is just contemporary events, you know, he suffered from ill health throughout the presidency, but he lived to a decent age, and he fathered a son very late in life, who also fathered a son very late in life. And recently, and very sadly, his grandson, Harrison Ruffin Tyler, died on May 25th. So he still had a grandson living, you know, until recently, and 235 years after his grandfather's birth. This was always one of the favorite facts of presidential nerds, which we'll have to come up with a new one
now. So good genes at play there, right? Zachary Taylor then, he liked a lot of cherries.
Yeah, he ate a ton of cherries and ice milk and then fell ill. And it was rumored that he'd been poisoned, possibly by the Jesuits, which was a popular anti-Catholic conspiracy theory at the time. So he was exhumed with the support of his relatives in 1991. And they didn't find any evidence of poisoning, but they did think that he's yet another victim of Washington's sewers, that he may well have contracted some disease from that.
Typhoid or something like that?
I believe it was typhoid, yeah.
Chester A. Arthur then. What happened to Chester?
Well, he's the first of the presidents who really actively conceal their illness. He was diagnosed soon after Garfield's death. He was Garfield's vice president, becomes president, with Bright's disease, which is a kidney disease, which is potentially fatal, and certainly at the time was seen to be fatal in a relatively short term. He didn't want people to know about that, and even though rumors of his ill health were spreading, so he traveled to Florida, which didn't work, and then to Yellowstone Park, which as a way of promoting the new idea of a national park, which did give him some relief. But because of these rumors of his ill health, he was unable to secure the nomination for an actual full term, a second term, and died soon after that election.
So it sounds, if he got out of the city, that it was well known in these times that Washington was a sort of an unhealthy place to be.
I think people were starting to draw that conclusion after the death of various presidents. And I mean, presidents complain about their social schedule. Tyler was very fatigued by the initial brutal social schedule which he was facing, as were a number of frequent presidents. They had to meet all these office seekers and try to either say yes or no to them, and fatally in saying no in Garfield's case. And getting out of Washington was very, very important to them. So maybe there's something in trips to Mar-a-Lago, right? Even Garfield, and as part of his recovery, was moved to a supporter's mansion on the coast, you know, as a way of just getting him away from a fetid Washington.
Getting him some healthy air and water, most importantly. So we're going to move to the 1890s now, into Grover Cleveland.
Yeah, no, he, had discovered a cancerous lesion in his mouth in 1893 during his second term, but he was under a lot of pressure because of the economy, which was not good. And he was going to have to talk to the Congress in a couple months about the silver issue, you know, and all of the things monetary. And he thought that being seen to be in ill health would make it even less palatable to have unpopular economic measures. So they arranged for a secret surgery to remove the tumor aboard a friend's yacht, where they brought a dentist as an anesthetist, and the two surgeries were performed. A lot of his palate was removed, including two teeth, which came in handy when rumors of this secret surgery aboard a yacht came out. He said, oh, well, there was a dentist there. He just had a tooth removed, which was true.
It was good cover,
but,
wasn't
but
it?
But a lot more was removed as well. They put an implant in so he could try to speak in a normal fashion, but not everybody was fooled, and he became much frailer after that, and his presidency basically wasn't a success after that.
I mean, you'd love to be in the room where, you know, these really intelligent people said, we're going to do the operation on a friend's yacht with a dentist in charge of the anesthetic.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Exactly. Yeah,
but they successfully covered it up. The actual truth didn't come out until 9 years after Cleveland was dead.
Woodrow Wilson had strokes at a young age, so he was facing challenges from the get-go.
Yeah, this is the most famous case because he's had a series of strokes throughout his life, and he always downplayed them. It turns out he upplayed some of his other health conditions, but he always downplayed the stroke, perhaps because he knew it would affect his judgment and it would affect his possibility of surviving office. A lot of his physicians, because he had a number of them, and he went with the prognosis he liked.
He liked. Right? Yeah.
You know, we all do this maybe. You know, he suggested that he might not make it through his terms. And in 1919, he collapses on a speaking tour to promote the League of Nations, which eventually fails to be ratified by the American Congress because Woodrow Wilson is unable to really promote it sufficiently, or certainly isn't willing to promote his particularly hard-line version of it, because he has a massive stroke after that, is paralyzed on one side, can barely see out of the other side's eye, and this is covered up by his doctor and by the then First Lady. This is Roosevelt's second First Lady, and they're basically running the country. You know, they determine who gets to see Roosevelt, and that's not a lot of people. They determine what documents he sees. So it goes back to that decision-making power. And neuroscientists or neurologists have gone and looked at Wilson's behavior after the stroke, and they conclude that it significantly impaired his judgment, and that he was much more reckless, that he had poor impulse control, that he, you know, was more emotionally driven in his decisions. And so while he may be just as intelligent as he was before, his decisions changed for the worse. And, you know, there was talk among the cabinet about replacing him. They kept this hushed up for a long time, but when it became obvious after his recovery that he was not fully recovered, there was talk about replacing him, but there wasn't the political will among the cabinet or with the vice president. Yeah. Wilson wanted to run for a third term. So important was his legacy, but that was completely impossible given his
distinct
condition.
Distinct echoes of what we've seen over the last year or so, right?
We've been there before.
We certainly have. Franklin D. Roosevelt, then, tell us a little bit about his story. So he had some of the same doctors that we've just been talking about in the Woodrow Wilson case.
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson's doctor, who was, again, a friend of Woodrow Wilson's, Kerry Grayson, you know, ended up treating a younger FDR for various things, especially the polio he contracted. Mm-hmm. One of the things they covered up for FDR was his disability, which tells you a lot about the times, right? You know, he didn't ever appear insofar as possible in a wheelchair, which he used almost all the time, because he could walk with braces and assistance and canes. And there's a couple of occasions where he fell over, but they thought he would not succeed as a politician if he was seen in a wheelchair. But what they also covered up from FDR, who knew about the wheelchair, was his hypertension, which eventually killed him. Again, they downplayed it to the president because he didn't want to know, basically.
Thank you so much, Graham, for taking us through all of that. Graham Finlay there from the UCD School of International Relations. Now, coming up, we're going to hear the incredible story behind the hit book, Inner Excellence.